A look at our headlines. Israeli forces killed four Palestinians, including two teenagers, during separate raids in the occupied West Bank cities of Nablus and Al-Khalil. Britain is planning power cuts during winter in anticipation of gas shortages resulting from Western bans on Russia's energy sector. And Russia says oil supply to three European countries through Ukraine has stopped over financial problems caused by Western sanctions. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour, four Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Israeli military killed three Palestinians, including a fighter and member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Ibrahim Al-Nabulsi in Nablus. A fourth Palestinian was killed during a protest in Al-Khalil. More in this report.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim Al-Nabulsi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where Al-Nabulsi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate Al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nabulsi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been worrying Israeli military. They carried out a number of shootings against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian.
It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim Al-Nabulsi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
A group of Iranian rights activists have gathered in the capital, Tehran, to condemn Israel's recent aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip. Yusuf Shaloli reports.
Stop the massacre, chant these angry protesters who converged on the Palestine Square in Tehran to denounce the latest Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip, which left 46 Palestinians dead, including 16 children.
We gather today en masse to show our solidarity with Palestinians. We also want to raise awareness of the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people.
We never cease to support our Palestinian brothers and sisters. Why are the world rights entities keeping mum while Israel continues to kill innocent people in Gaza?
Tensions have escalated between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Friday, when Israel carried out airstrikes on cities across the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, killing dozens of people, including two commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. The Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, responded by firing hundreds of rockets towards Israel, putting the Israeli forces on the back foot. Activists here say the Islamic Jihad's show of force has pushed Tel Aviv into calling for a ceasefire, which took effect on Sunday.
In the past, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians would go unanswered. But today, as soon as Israel carries out a strike, the resistance responds immediately with its rockets. So, the era of hit and run is over.
The conflict is the worst outbreak of violence between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Operation Sword al-Quds, an 11-day war last May. The UN Security Council has expressed deep concern over the situation in the Gaza Strip during an emergency meeting held on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli aggression on the besieged territory.
While the UN has expressed its concern over the escalating violence against Palestinians, activists here say this is not enough. They called on the international body to stop paying lip service and take action to keep Israel from further violation of security in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Processions are held across Lebanon to commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein. The highlight of the processions was a speech by the Hezbollah leader who declared significant stances on the latest development.
On Tuesday, thousands of Lebanese marked Ashura, the martyrdom anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's grandson and the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein. One of the most pivotal speeches of Hezbollah Secretary General is usually given on this day. This year was no exception. Addressing hundreds of mourners in Beirut, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah outlined main stances of the resistance movement.
Today, on the day of the oppressed, our message to our enemy is that they need to know who they are facing and that in Lebanon there is a resistance that has proven that it can defeat the army, which was said to be invincible, and it is ready to go to new heights.
Sayyid Nasrallah warned that Hezbollah will not sit idly by if Israel carries out its threats to assassinate leaders of the Palestinian resistance groups in Lebanon.
We tell the enemy, do not miscalculate your moves against Lebanon, or the people of Lebanon, or the resistance in Lebanon, not on the issue of petrol or gas, or maritime demarcation, and do not make the mistake of launching any assault. In the last few days, we heard that they are plotting to assassinate figures from Islamic Jihad or Hamas, or other Palestinian factions in Lebanon. On Ashura, I tell them that any assault against any person in Lebanon will not go unpunished.
The Hezbollah leaders stressed that the movement will take action based on the response that Beirut will get from Israel on the issue of maritime resources. Nasrallah said Hezbollah will by no means compromise on Lebanon's rights. Muslims across Lebanon hold mourning processions for 10 days in Muharram to remember the horrific crimes which were committed against the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein, and his family and companions in the plains of Karbala in modern-day Iraq in 680 AD. This historic tragedy remains very much alive in the hearts and minds of the mourners to this day.
Imam Hussein was killed more than 1,000 years ago, but he is still alive in our hearts today, and he is our leader in this fight against Israel and Americans' aggressions.
The injustice happening around the world, the oppression that's going on, everything has been linked to what Imam Hussein suffered with his family 1,400 years ago, because the message that has conveyed in Karbala is conveying nowadays, because as we know, every day is Ashura and every land is Karbala, and that's what we say in Arabic.
The Lebanese mourners also hoisted Palestinian flags along with black and red banners of mourning to show that the day of Ashura is the day where the oppressed fight back.
The Ashura commemoration for Hezbollah and its supporters goes beyond the obvious religious rituals. It has defined their stance in the face of U.S.-Israeli policies, not only as a military resistance, but also as a deeply rooted political and social movement. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Streets in parts of Muslim-majority Kashmir flooded with mourners clad in black, waving flags and banners with messages from the battlefield of Karbala written over them. Young and old, men and women participated in the mourning ceremonies on the day of Ashura. Ashura marks the day when Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred by forces of tyrant Yazid in Karbala. To carry forward Imam Hussein's legacy, centuries after the Battle of Karbala, Imam Hussein's martyrdom is commemorated across the globe.
These processions during the month of Muharram have a message. First, to keep the younger generations posted, and second, to not let the world forget how good one over the evil.
Reciting elegies, chanting pro-Islamic slogans, and the resonating sound of chest beating, every eye is moist in memory of the battle for humanity.
We have been entrusted with a mission, and it becomes our responsibility to carry the lessons and teachings forward so that our upcoming generations know their legacy well.
Each year during the holy month of Muharram, religious organizations and groups organize seminars, processions and lectures. Here in Kashmir, authorities have demarcated the routes for Muharram processions, mostly in Shia-dominated areas. Following a three-decade-old ban imposed on Muharram processions through traditional routes, authorities in sensitive Kashmir believe these emotional mourning processions may turn into a law and order problem, thus arrangements are made in confined areas.
For Muslims, the event of Karbala marks a new beginning of resilience. The processions held year after year reinforce integrity towards the mission of truth, justice and peace initiated by Imam Hussein some 1400 years ago on the battlefield of Karbala. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Prayers and rhythmic chest beating are part of mourning ceremonies in Pakistan's city of Karachi to mark Ashura, which commemorates the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. These black-clad mourners are here to pay tribute to Prophet Muhammad's grandson, who sacrificed his life along with his 72 companions in the epic but unequal Battle of Karbala. Imam Hussein's tragic story still attracts millions across various creeds, classes and geographical lines. Here in the port city of Karachi, lovers of Imam Hussein's converged at the city center to commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of their beloved Imam, who was martyred some 14 centuries ago by Yazid. These mourners walked miles on foot to commemorate the great tragedy of Karbala and to protest against tyrant of the time.
It is all about the love and the sacrifice done by him for the Islam. And the real motive behind this is that we want the people to remember this every year. Just don't like other wars. We don't want this thing to be forgotten, just like other things which have been happening in our world. So the real motive is that this thing should not be suppressed. We want to remake it. We want to memorize this thing so other the coming generation can know.
Abu Abdullah knew that Yazid was wrong. That's why he took a stand against him and was brutally martyred on 10th of Muharram.
Hussein is not only for Shias, okay? Hussein is for Alam, the world, the universe. Hussein isn't a public figure, isn't a figure or human being, he's more than that. So his wisdom is more than that.
Mourning rituals climax on Ashura, the 10th day of Muharram, first month of Islamic lunar calendar. This tragic day was sparked when the third Shia Imam refused to pledge allegiance to Yazid, the tyrant of his time.
We always regret that 1400 years ago we weren't there. So we feel that we should have been with Imam Hussein alayhi salam at the time of his martyrdom. So we are the azadar of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, as he was killed mercilessly by the Yazid forces.
We have gathered here to basically remember the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the basic martyrdom of Imam Hussein that took place. Basically, it's a little bit of, you know, a misconception that people think that they fought over, the water in River Furat, but basically it was more towards the basic concepts of Islam and its basic necessities.
Pakistanis traditionally cook and distribute food and beverages called Nazr-e Imam Hussein among people in and out of mourning ceremonies. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the allegations and fallacies of the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, regarding the situation of Yemeni children throughout the years of Saudi war on Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Washili has more in this report.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference on the dire situation of Yemeni children amid the years-long Saudi war on the country. The ministry has criticized the United Nations for its inaction on Saudi atrocities.
When the United Nations removed Saudi Arabia from the list of violators of children's rights, it encouraged the kingdom to continue killing Yemeni children and targeting service facilities for children such as schools, hospitals and health centers. It also prevented the entry of humanitarian and medical aid for children. We know that there are UN reports that talk about the spread of malnutrition amongst children, along with many chronic diseases that need care. But unfortunately, there is no real action to save the children of Yemen.
Officials say the UN has collaborated with the Saudi led coalition in killing Yemeni children by providing political cover up for Riyadh's violations. Moreover, the world body removed the kingdom from the list of groups accused of violating children's rights.
The United Nations is a clear and prominent partner in the aggressive war on Yemen, and we have in the 8 years of war clear evidence that the United Nations participated in all the crimes committed against the Yemenis and did not condemn Saudi Arabia for its crimes, but rather the victims bear everything the executioner does. The United Nations has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children through its silence and coverage of Saudi crimes. It has also removed Saudi Arabia 5 times from the list of violators of children's rights.
According to human rights groups, more than 9,000 children have been killed or maimed by Saudi airstrikes since the beginning of the war in 2015. Health officials say more than 1 million children are suffering from malnutrition, one of the highest numbers in the world.
Human rights activists say the United Nations is hostage to Saudi Arabia's funding for its programs. They say the world body has contributed to the killing of Yemeni children because of its silence on Saudi crimes. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
Britain is mulling contingency plans to deal with possible energy shortages this winter amid tensions between the West and Russia that have led to disruptions in energy markets worldwide. Media reports say Britain is planning scheduled blackouts for industry and households. The government's report predicting worst-case scenarios says the UK might be forced to trigger emergency measures to conserve gas for 4 days in January. The government report says the coming winter, electricity capacity shortfall could total about a sixth of peak demand. In such a case, the UK will have to approach Europe for pipeline shipments of gas. But the continent is already facing low supply from Russia. Moscow cites technical and financial problems as the reason for reduced gas exports. The West has placed massive sanctions on Russia, particularly its energy industry. That's a wrap for this hour's World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Water shortages across the European continent, from France through Italy, Spain and beyond, are creating a critical situation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalists John Henley, Stephen Bergen, Angela Giuffrida and Philip Alterman. The piece is titled The New Normal, How Europe is Being Hit by a Climate-Driven Drought Crisis. Please stay with us for more. Europe's most severe drought in decades is hitting homes, factories, farmers and freight across the continent, as experts warn drier winters and searing summers, fueled by global heating, mean water shortages will become the new normal in Europe. The European Union European Drought Observatory has calculated that 45% of the bloc's territory was under drought warning by mid-July, with 15% already on red alert, prompting the European Commission to warn of a critical situation in multiple regions. Conditions have deteriorated since, as repeated heat waves roll across the European continent. In France, the Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, last week activated a crisis unit to tackle a drought, Meteor France, described as the country's worst since records began in 1958. More than 100 French municipalities have no running drinking water and are being supplied by truck, Green Transition Minister Christophe Béchu said, adding, "We're going to have to get used to episodes of this type. Adaptation is no longer an option, it's an obligation." With surface soil humidity the lowest ever recorded in Europe and July rainfall 85% lower than usual, water restrictions including hosepipe and irrigation bans are in place in 93 of France's 96 mainland departments, with 62 classified as in crisis. Amid rising food prices following the Russia-Ukraine conflict, France's agriculture minister warned the corn harvest is likely to be more than 18% lower than last year, while farmers' unions say a shortage of cattle fodder as a result of the drought could lead to significant milk shortages in the coming autumn and winter. The electricity utility, EDF, was last week forced to reduce output from one of its nuclear reactors in southwestern France because of high water temperatures in the Garonne River, and has issued multiple similar warnings for reactors along the Rhone. Spain's water reserves are at an all-time low of 40% and have been falling at a rate of 1.5% a week through a combination of increased consumption and evaporation, according to the Spanish government, in what is likely to be the driest of the past 60 years. The country has received less than half its expected rainfall for the time of year for the past 3 months. With restrictions in place from Catalonia in the northeast to Galicia in the northwest, as well as western Extremadura and Andalusia in the south. Most water restrictions have been imposed on domestic users in Spain, with rural authorities often reluctant to rein in farmers' frequently illegal exploitation of an increasingly scant resource, despite agriculture accounting for 9/10 of Spain's water consumption. A post-pandemic tourism revival has also led to a rise in consumption by as much as 10% in cities such as Barcelona, where, if there is no rainfall soon and none is forecast, restrictions are likely to be imposed next month. Climate change studies warn that droughts are going to be more intense and more frequent and longer, said Nuria Hernandez-Moro, the co-founder of the New Water Culture. This is going to be the new normal in Europe, and yet we continue to approve the increased use of a resource we don't have and which is becoming scarcer. This year is also said to become the hottest and driest ever year recorded in Italy. I don't know what we need to do any more to make the climate crisis a political theme, said Luca Mercalli, the president of the Italian Meteorological Society. No similar data in the last 230 years compares with the drought and the heat wave we're experiencing this year. Then we have had storms. These episodes are growing in frequency and intensity, exactly as forecast by climate reports over the last 30 years. Why do we continue to wait to make this a priority? One of the most prominent manifestations of the crisis is the parched River Po in northern Italy. The flow rate of Italy's longest waterway has fallen to one-tenth of the usual figure, while its water level is 2 meters below normal. The Italian government declared a drought emergency in 5 northern regions of Italy, rationing drinking water in early July. Villagers around Lake Maggiore are being supplied by truck. With no sustained rainfall in the region since last November, risotto rice production in the Po Valley, which accounts for about 40% of Italy's agricultural output, is under threat. Growers have warned that up to 60% of the crop may be lost as paddy fields dry out and turn salty, with record low water levels allowing more seawater into the delta. The water crisis is not confined to southern Europe. Water levels have also fallen to dangerous low levels on the Rhine, a vital northwest European waterway used to transport oil, petrol, coal and other raw materials that connects Germany's industrial heartland to the major ports of Rotterdam and Antwerp in the Netherlands. The river's level on Monday, 8th of August, was already lower than at the same point in 2018, when a severe drought eventually halted goods transport for 132 days. Some vessels are operating at 25% capacity to avoid running aground, driving up freight costs. The drought has hit German waterways just as freight vessels are supposed to carry increased amounts of coal in order to service the power plants that the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has reactivated in the face of Russia throttling deliveries of natural gas to Germany. In the capital Berlin, authorities have recorded falling water levels at the many lakes fed by the River Spree. In the southern city of Nuremberg, dried out urban trees are being watered from municipal indoor swimming pools, closed to save gas. In Switzerland, the dairy industry has been hardest hit. Authorities in Freiburg, Jura and Neuchâtel have had to open valley meadows not usually used for grazing until September, since pastures higher up the mountains were already too dry. Dominique de Boumann, the chairman of Freiburg's cheesemaking cooperative, told Le Temps newspaper that production of cheese and milk was likely to be hit this year. Dominique de Boumann said, "A fall can be predicted and we may even end up with a shortage of Gruyere," he said. In Obwalden Canton near Lucerne, the army had to be called in to transport water by helicopter from Lake Sarnen to thirsty cows in the village of Kerns. The Netherlands declared an official water shortage last week. The Dutch government has not yet introduced restrictions on household water consumption, but has asked people to think carefully about whether they need to wash their car or completely fill a paddling pool. In neighbouring Belgium, meanwhile, forecasters reported the driest July since 1885. Despite a ban on farmers pumping water for crops, groundwater levels in Flanders are exceptionally low at the moment, causing peatlands to dry out, raising concern about wildlife, including snipe. Canals and rivers are also in bad shape. Local authorities report many fish have died, as the only water left in some waterways is industrial or sewage effluent. 13 communities in the Ardennes have banned people from filling their swimming pools. Scientists have said climate breakdown could soon lead to summer droughts becoming more frequent in Western Europe, with extreme heat events that once occurred once a decade happening every 2 or every 3 years, unless governments around the world radically cut their carbon emissions.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Ilmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much. Jazakallah.
Well, friends play an important role in everybody's life. But brother, you know, one aspect that teenagers are faced with is peer pressure from friends, which I guess comes from choosing the right friends. Could you shed some more light on this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So as you mentioned very rightly, that friends play a very important role in our lives.
Yeah.
And this is something that nobody can deny.
Mm-hmm.
We've all seen this. And a lot of importance has been given to this topic in the discussion of psychology and sociology and youth studies generally. And you find that Islam has also given a lot of importance on this topic, and there's plenty of verses of the Holy Quran as well as hadith from the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam, to discuss this very important topic and to advise us and to guide us into ensuring that this very important factor in our lives is a positive factor. It's a positive impact in our lives. And you find that the Holy Quran talks about this very clearly. So for example, to just give you a verse of the Quran before we begin, you have in Surah Furqan, verse 25, and the people of hell, for example, will complain, Ya waylata, laytani lam attakhidh fulanan khalila. Oh, how I wish, it's a sense of a very sense of deep regret. Okay. I wish, a regret that you can't go back and change anything now. Mm-hmm. You're faced with the consequence of what you did. And the blame comes on what? What is he blaming on? He says, "Lam attakhidh fulanan khalila." I wish I hadn't taken such a person as a friend.
Okay.
Right? And you find in other verses as well as in other riwayat as well, we have this, that the sadiq, the friend, the khalil, these people that are friends with me are going to naturally have a very strong impact in me. In fact, you find, for example, in the discussion of spouse selection, that if you want to, if you're looking for a spouse, whether a boy is looking for a girl to get married to her, or a girl is looking to get married to a boy, one of the ways to find out more about this person is to find out who their friends are. Mm. Why? Because we're told, even in hadith, we have this as well, that a person's religion is his friend's religion.
Okay. Right?
So
Man is known by the company he keeps.
Exactly. That's another proverb as well that we have.
Yes.
So we have this in hadith a lot, that if you want to know somebody, look at their friends. And so friends have a very big impact in our lives. And therefore, what's very important for us is to make sure that we use this impact, this factor in our life, in a positive way.
Okay.
And at this, on the other side as well, you'll find that many sad stories, many bad endings are due to friends. So with the verse we mentioned over here.
Yeah.
And you find as well, when you talk to youth and you ask them, you ask them like the mistakes that they've done when they were teenagers, or the mistakes that they were involved in, that they will very often say, "Oh, it was because of this person. It was because of my friend. I wish if I hadn't listened to him, if I hadn't taken him as my friend, I would be a different person, or I would be doing things very differently."
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to realize this. And the key discussion, or one of the key discussions in this regard, is to talk about the choice that we have in making a rational choice in choosing our friends.
All right.
So let me share a few points, y'all. Let's take a break and then share a few points regarding this.
Yes, sure. Let's take a short break. We'll be back after a short break. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. Yes, brother, we're talking about friends.
So let me mention the Arabic of the hadith I pointed out before the break. So, al-mar'u ala dini khalilih. A person is on the religion of his friend.
Mm-hmm.
This is from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. Amir al-Mu'minin says that in a hadith, if a person is unknown to you, man ishtabaha alaykum amruhu walam ta'arifu, if you don't know somebody, if you don't know his amr, walam ta'arifu dinahu, fanzuru ila khulata'ihi, then look at the people around him.
All right.
So if there's somebody whom you don't know about, so in spouse selection, for example, or in any setting, if you want to know somebody, find out whose friends are.
All right.
And experience has shown this as well. Many times I've tried this as well. I've seen it. If you want to know somebody, then you look at their friends. What's very important to realize, and just to take the discussion further as well, is that we have two types of people that we hang around with, or two types of friend. Let me share this hadith with you. Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam says, let me read the entire hadith. قَامَ رَجُلٌ بِالْبَصْرَةِ إِلَى أَمِيرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. A person from Basra comes. Mm-hmm. Look at what question he asks for Amir al-Mu'minin. He says, يَا أَمِيرَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ أَخْبِرْنَا عَنِ الْإِخْوَانِ. tell us about friendship. Tell us about brotherhood.
Okay.
فقال عليه السلام, Amir al-Mu'minin says, الإخوان صنفان. The brotherhood or friends are of two types. إخوان الثقة وإخوان المكاشرة. You have the friends that are called the إخوان الثقة. They are those reliable friends, those true friends, those close friends.
Mm-hmm.
In our own language, we count them as our best friends. Exactly. وإخوان المكاشرة. These are friends of enjoyment, if you want to translate it literally. It means people that you hang around with, people you have fun with. But mm-hmm. they're not people that you would necessarily rely on or you would trust them with anything.
Okay.
They're people that you, when you go out for a coffee or you go play football or you go to the cinema, you're together basically. You have fun together.
You hang around with them.
But when it comes for exam time, for example, when it comes to your parents did something to you and you need a person to talk to.
Shoulder now.
A shoulder now. These are not the people that you go to basically. You go to the first kind of people, the Ikhwan al-Thiqa.
Mm-hmm.
So Amir al-Mu'minin very beautifully shows us that there's these two types of friends. So what's important for us is to realize the influence of these two types of friends.
Okay, well, to know more on that, I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the role of friends in the teenager's life. Yes, brother, you share some beautiful verses, you share some beautiful hadiths. What is more in the story?
When we talk about the influence of friends that we have, very interestingly, you find that both of these types of friends that I talked about, both of them have a very important influence on me. At what level, you would ask? I would say at multiple levels. The first level where friends have an influence is at the level of actions.
Okay.
You can imagine, I remember when I taught this in a class, I used this example. I think it went very well. It went down very well with the students and the youth. Imagine a bubble, right? An energy bubble.
Okay.
When you're with friends, what happens is that in that circle, a kind of energy bubble is created between the friends that are there. In such a way that this leads to an action. And it's very difficult when you're within that circle to go against that energy. You're always stuck within that energy and you act based on that energy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why, for example, it's extremely difficult and it takes an extreme amount of power to tell your friend off when you're in that circle. So imagine this scene where you're all sitting together and you're having a laugh with 3, 4, 5 of your friends, basically. You've been there for a long time, for a few hours now. You're making loads of jokes and doing things together. And suddenly a person passes in front of you and some of your friends laugh at him or her. Right? There's a very little chance that even though you know this is the wrong thing that just happened,
mm-hmm.
right, that shouldn't have happened, but to stand against it is very difficult.
All right.
In fact, most people will actually do it and actually join in the mocking or making fun of a third person.
All right.
Why? Because it's part of that energy that's going around in this circle right now.
All right.
And so my actions are very much influenced by this group. When I come out of it, let's say at night, for example, imagine you see that person again that you're making fun of. You won't be making fun of that person anymore.
Yes.
You're actually speaking to him in a very respectful way.
Yes.
Right? And if you were to turn around and say, but this is not how you behaved with me this afternoon, when we were passing around, you would tell him that that's because we were together with friends and it was a laugh, basically.
We were going with the flow.
Exactly. So you find that when you have a group of friends together, an energy is created that drives our actions.
Okay.
And it requires a lot to come out of it, not to be influenced by it, or even more energy to go against it and say, guys, please stop. What we're doing right now is not correct.
All right.
And so you find that friends influence our actions at a very high level. This was a an example that happens at a physical level. Now, in the social media, it's the same thing as well. When you see social media people on Facebook together as friends,
mm-hmm.
or on Instagram, or all the social medias are out there, you find again that we're influenced, and to go against that, like let's say all your friends have a particular type of photo, a profile photo of mm-hmm. themselves.
All right.
For you to come out and put a black hijab, for example, a black scarf and a black hijab photo of yourself in a very modest way from very far, to stand out, this will be a very difficult task.
Okay.
And so you see how friends influence your actions.
All right. So sometimes we are driven by the things what our friends do. And you said that it's a lot of energy. And in order to come out of that and stand against that what is not right morally, we need to have a lot of energy again to stand out of that group. Well, that was all for today. Thank you so much, brother, for joining us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for a program, please feel free to contact us on EnglishRadio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi aman Allah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Liz Truss suffered a humiliating setback in her bid to become the next Prime Minister on Tuesday, 9th of August, as she was forced into a U-turn on civil service pay after a backlash from within her own party. The Foreign Secretary swiftly abandoned the cornerstone of her plan for a war on Whitehall waste when it was revealed it could lead to pay cuts for millions of teachers, nurses and police officers. The article you're about to hear has been written by Guardian columnists Heather Stewart and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Truss Suffers Setback as Criticism of Civil Service Pay Plan Brings U-Turn. Liz Truss suffered a humiliating setback in her bid to become the next Prime Minister of Britain on Tuesday, as she was forced into a U-turn on civil service pay after a backlash from within her own party. The Foreign Secretary swiftly abandoned the cornerstone of her plan for a war on Whitehall waste when it was revealed it could lead to pay cuts for millions of teachers, nurses and police officers. The Foreign Secretary had proposed creating regional pay boards to set civil sector pay, matching it more closely to local labour markets outside of London and the southeast of England. But it was scrapped within hours after analysts pointed out the purported £8.8 billion saving from the policy was only remotely achievable by cutting wages across the public sector. With ballot papers dropping this week, Liz Truss is widely regarded as the front-runner in the race to succeed Boris Johnson. But one new opinion poll put her just 5 percentage points ahead of Rishi Sunak, while Conservative MPs say many members remain undecided. The Teesside Mayor, Ben Hoochan, a popular figure within the Conservative Party and its Rishi Sunak backer, said he was speechless at the policy, which he said would work against the flagship Conservative policy of levelling up. There is simply no way you can do this without a massive pay cut for 5.5 million people, including nurses, police officers and our armed forces outside of London. So much that we've worked for in places like Teesside would be undone, he said. Redwall MPs, including Jacob Young and Richard Holden, had also raised alarm at the policy announced overnight, as well as the former Cabinet Minister Simon Hart, who said it would amount to cuts of nearly £3,000 for workers in Wales. Liz Truss abruptly withdrew the policy on Tuesday, little more than 12 hours after it had been floated, claiming in an awkward interview that it had been misrepresented. There has never any intention to affect teachers and nurses, but I don't want to worry people. I don't want people to be concerned. So I'm being very clear that we will not be going ahead with the regional pay boards, she told ITV. Asked if the move was a U-turn, Liz Truss said, I'm someone who is honest and upfront, and I do what I say I will do, and I'm being clear, I will not be doing that. Liz Truss had previously appeared to be cruising to victory in the race, picking up the support of cabinet colleagues Ben Wallace and Brandon Lewis, and her former leadership rivals Penny Mordaunt and Tom Tugendhat in recent days. Rishi Sunak, meanwhile, has announced a series of increasingly hardline promises in a bid to stay in the race, including capping the number of refugees, doubling the number of foreign criminals deported, and taking on what he called left-wing agitators in a culture war over gender identity. His campaign team responded to Liz Truss's statement with barely disguised glee, with a spokesperson claiming the misstep showed a lack of serious judgment and a worrying lack of grip on detail in what is already a woolly economic plan. If this was in a general election, it would have been a potentially fatal own goal for the Conservatives, they added, suggesting that Liz Truss has supported the policy since 2018 when she was Chief Secretary to the Treasury. Several Sunak supporters compared the turn of events to Theresa May's dementia tax, the deeply unpopular plan to fund social care that contributed to the Tories losing their majority in the 2017 general election. Mark Harper, a former Chief Whip who is supporting Rishi Sunak, said scrapping the proposal also meant there was now an £8.8 billion hole in Liz Truss's tax and spending plans. An economic policy that can't be paid for isn't very conservative. Mrs. Thatcher would be livid, he said, accusing Liz Truss of blaming journalists for misconstruing her plans. The Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davey said, U-turning on a multi-billion pound policy 5 weeks before even taking office must be a new record. We can't let Liz Truss run the country with the same incompetence she's running her leadership campaign. The British people must have their say in a general election. Meanwhile, the Labour Party said the original plan would have meant a £7.1 billion hit to local economies across Yorkshire, the North and the Midlands. Angela Rayner, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, said Liz Truss is a liability who has lingered in this Tory cabinet for nearly a decade in which the Tories have fuelled a cost-of-living crisis. Alex Thomas, a programme director at the Institute for Government think tank, pointed out that the whole annual civil service pay bill was about £9 billion. Tony Wilson, director of the Institute for Employment Studies, said Liz Truss's policy appeared to date back to a time when public sector pay outstripped the private sector's. But the latest data showed it was at £20 a week lower on average. The new leadership opinion poll, including 807 Conservative members, was conducted by Techni for a private client and showed just a 5 percentage point gap between the two candidates, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. Separate polling by YouGov for the Times on Tuesday before the U-turn had the Foreign Secretary with a huge 34-point lead and a 60% of the membership saying they would vote for her. Liz Truss gained the backing of the Daily Mail on Tuesday, having already won the support of the Telegraph. Signs her public sector pay policy was in difficulty began on Tuesday morning when Jacob Rees-Mogg, a backer of Truss and a minister in charge of civil service efficiency, said it was not the plan at the moment to cut pay for the wider public sector to make savings of £8.8 billion promised by Truss. The discussion at the moment is around civil servants, he said. In the original release, which proposed regional pay boards, Liz Truss said she would tailor pay to the cost of living where civil servants actually work, and this would save up to £8.8 billion. It said the policy could be adopted for all public sector workers in the long term.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.